Many people around the country are preparing for this Y2K New Year's Eve by stocking up on bottled water, flashlight batteries, and canned beans. But book critic Maureen Corrigan says that the most important thing to have at hand as we prepare to enter the unknown of the second millennium is an armload of the best books of the first millennium. Here's her list.
The future is a different country, and it's hard to know how to pack for it. I'm talking about books, not clothes. I always worry about taking enough of the right books with me on trips, and stepping into the new millennium feels like starting off on the second leg of a long journey. So what to pack? What to pack? Of course, the Bible, Homer and Dante, Shakespeare and Milton. But I'd send those weighty volumes fourth-class mail, book rate. No hurry, they'll get there. It's the carry-on luggage I'm most concerned about. What kind of literature from the first millennium do I want to have with me should the second millennium turn out to be inhospitable? Humor, no question. Because when I've dipped into, say, medieval courtly love poetry, I've been struck by the chill strangeness of an older age. But when I've read the jokes that monks of the Middle Ages scribbled in the margins of their illuminated manuscripts, I've always felt a jolt of recognition, the sense of shared humanity that humor brings. Stepping into the unknown future, I want the comfort of centuries of comedy so I can laugh in the dark. First, on my personal, and that means Anglophilic, literary packing list would be Chaucer, the deadest of the dead white males whose writings have made me smile. Certainly I'd take the Canterbury Tales, starring one of the funniest women in all of literature, the lusty, gapped-tooth wife of Bath. But I'd also want charming, shorter works, like The Parliament of Fowls, in which Chaucer indulges in political satire under the cover story of a gathering of noisy birds squawking over their respective mates. People quote the first line of The Parliament of Fowls all the time without crediting Chaucer. The life so short, the craft so long to learn. Shakespeare's comedies have to come along, even though some of them, like The Merchant of Venice and The Merry Wives of Windsor, aren't really that funny. To save luggage space, I'd limit myself to two. Twelfth Night, because I admire the shipwrecked Viola's spunk, and A Midsummer Night's Dream. Peas Blossom, Cobweb, Moth, and Mustard Seed. The names alone of its fairies make me love this play, although not everyone has been enchanted by its gossamer giggles. Upon seeing A Midsummer Night's Dream in 1662, the famous English diarist Samuel Pepys wrote, "This is the most insipid, ridiculous play that I ever saw in my life." With a name like Pepys, you'd think he would have learned to lighten up. The 18th century was a very witty time in English literature. There's Jonathan Swift. Gulliver's Travels leaves me cold, but I'd surely take what many consider to be the most brilliant political satire in the English language, A Modest Proposal. I'd also stuff into my bag the long comic poem, The Dunciad, that Alexander Pope dedicated to Swift. In the wicked couplets of The Dunciad, Pope impales just about every one of his literary rivals. And then I'd have to make room in my carry-on for the two comic geniuses who appeared towards the turn of the 18th century, Byron and Austen. Give me Byron's bawdy belly laughs any day over the nature mewlings of his fellow romantics. He may have been a cad, but I fell in love with Byron 20 years ago when I first read his mock epic, Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. I'd have to somehow squeeze in all of Jane Austen's novels, except for her Juvenalia and The Grim Persuasion. And thinking of funny novels reminds me that I can't leave the 18th century without turning back and grabbing Lawrence Stern's masterpiece of a shaggy dog story, Tristram Shandy. Dickens is my favorite novelist of all time, and of all his comic creations, I love Mr. Micawber the best, so David Copperfield comes with me into the next millennium. So does Samuel Butler's end-of-the-century hoot, The Way of All Flesh, and all of Oscar Wilde's plays, and everything he ever said or was reputed to say. And speaking of champion literary talkers, I also want complete transcripts of Dorothy Parker's Round Table Bon Mots. I can barely lift these two bags, and I've still got to jam in 20th century comic literature. I've reread Barbara Pym's first novel, Some Tame Gazelle, and Kingsley Amis's academic satire, Lucky Jim, nearly every year for at least a decade, so they're coming, even if I have to grip them between my teeth. The same goes for Nabokov's Lolita, the literary apotheosis of bad taste humor. I'm staggering now under the weight of all this comedy, and I've got to stop packing. But I refuse to leave the 20th century without Stevie Smith. Her poems will just have to fit under my chin. Like many of these other comic masters across the ages, Smith led a sad life. But oh, did she know how to make a reader happy. Ruminating on the end of this century makes me think of Smith's poem Nodding, which pokes sly fun at the Big Bang apocalyptic literature of male contemporaries like T.S. Eliot. In it, a woman sits in her cottage on a dark, wintry night, listening to the tick of the clock. Here's the final stanza. One laughs on a night like this, in a room half firelight, half dark, with a great lump of a cat moving on the hearth, and the twigs tapping quick, and the owl in an absolute fit. One laughs, supposing creation pays for its long plodding simply by coming to this. Cat, night, fire, and a girl nodding.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University.